This is the third taped interview with Jesse Haver Butler. It will be numbered A3 since, as explained, it is not in sequence. The interview took place on January 4th, 1973 at Jesse Haver Butler's apartment at Hillcrest. The interview broke the chronological sequence that we have been developing, and instead of continuing and discussing the experiences in Boston for the Minimum Wage Commission and that initial involvement with a woman and her later experiences in Washington, we skipped over that period and spoke about some of her suffrage experiences. Jesse Haver Butler has been recovering from the flu and was somewhat sick today as well. She had difficulty with her voice and seemed particularly nervous. The tape is only approximately a half hour long and deals specifically with some of her reminiscences about Mrs. Catt. She first discusses the differences between the National American Woman Suffrage Association Party under Carrie Chapman Catt and contrasts this to Alice Paul's National Women's Party and their techniques. A good part of the interview actually discusses the differences between them. She reminisces somewhat about the picketing and arrests of Alice Paul's group. Although she never observed the picketing, she did lunch at the National Women's Party tea house and was familiar with the events and the people involved. She then goes on to discuss her trip through the West with Mrs. Catt for ratification, and finally tells a story about how Tennessee became involved in the final ratification.
4th, 1973, and I give notice of copyright that covers all the words that are to be said today. The scene of this story begins in Washington in the heat of the fight to get the resolution through the United States Senate to give the vote to the women of America. And this battle had been going on for years and was now in a very tight and close spot. And as everybody knows, there were two suffrage groups fighting for woman suffrage. One was led by Mrs. Carrie Chapman Catt, who had spent 50 years working for this subject, but was very much of a statistician and a parliamentarian. And she believed that this was the way to get it, through proper parliamentary procedure. And her record through America prior to this scene in Washington, it goes over many years and in many states. So now she's there to try and get the resolution through the United States Senate. Well, then Alice Paul was one of the younger members of her organization, and she had been taught by Mrs. Pankhurst in London. And Mrs. Pankhurst was a militant. She was the one, you know, that put put oil down the post office boxes and burned letters and did things like this. So Alice Paul followed her way of fighting. And in the end, Alice Paul took the position that if a man in the Democratic Party, for instance, would vote against woman suffrage, she would then bomb the whole party. And this Mrs. Catt violently disagreed with. She thought the only thing to do was to attack the man and his attitude, but not the whole party. And that's why they separated. But always in these great issues, it seems that there are those who are conservative and like to carry on in the conservative way, and that was Mrs. Catt's way and her leader's way, and Alice Paul, who liked to take the more dramatic step. Fortunately, Alice Paul had a lot of money given her by Mrs. August Belmont, so she had a house right on the side of Lafayette Park in front of the White House, and all of us went there too. So there was a lovely lunch room, and we all went there, including myself, and they kept hoping they could get me lined up with this more radical group. I couldn't, for one thing, because I was still a lobbyist at the Capitol for the National Consumers League. But by temperament, I was not easily persuaded with the more dramatic way of acting. Yet in my inner soul, I saw they were making more of a dent, in a way, than Mrs. Catt was with her polite legislative manner. So finally, Alice Paul and her group began burning the words of the president in Lafayette Park. And although the stories do not say so, I seem to remember they did finally burn his body in effigy in Lafayette Park. I seem to remember it because I remember thinking at the time how bold it was and yet disrespectful to the president. At any rate, he became very irritated about all this. He hadn't done a thing to help them get the vote, although the World War I was going on and he was giving out noble statements to the world about the right of freedom of people. But he didn't include women in his statements. But anyway, after this drastic attack, he finally decided that he would personally appear before the Senate in courtesy to Mrs. Catt, he explicitly made clear, and asked them to vote for the woman suffrage amendment. And I seem to remember that that's the first time any president had ever gone to the Congress and asked for a specific piece of legislation. I don't remember that had ever been done before. So it was a history-making occasion. And my boyfriend, with whom I later married, and I got tickets and sat in the balcony of the Senate the day he appeared and asked the Senate to vote for woman suffrage. And so it was a very historic occasion and very thrilling experience to be there when that happened. And very soon after that, the woman suffrage amendment was passed by the United States Senate. But then, of course, it was necessary to get the vote of ratification of 38 states, three-quarters of the states of the United States, then had to also vote on it to make it part of the United States Constitution. And so Mrs. Catt still had a long battle ahead of her. It's interesting to comment on what Alice Paul and her eager followers went through in this fight, because there was a law at that time that they could not picket at the White House, in front of the White House. And they could picket in Lafayette Park, and I think at the side, but not at the front. And so they were told that if they did picket at the front, they would be arrested. So they did picket, and they got arrested, and they were put in prison, and they went on the hunger strike. And the authorities were afraid they'd die there, and this would make martyrs of them and make a fool out of everybody. And so they forcefully fed the women while they were in the prison. And among those women was Mrs. Harvey Wiley, whose husband later created the Food and Drug Administration. And she was one of the leaders of Alice Paul. And Mrs. William Kent was another one. Her husband was on the Tariff Commission, and his wife was forcefully fed so they wouldn't die. And it was a very nasty and humiliating and horrible experience. And I don't remember how many women went through that experience, but many of them really practically never got their health back again from what they went through. So in a way, they really did what they felt was absolutely necessary and let themselves be martyrs at the time. I don't remember much about the picketing or the marching, because I was, of course, I was earning my own living and having to work at the time. But we used to all go and eat over at Alice Paul's restaurant and hear the latest news of what was going on. It was very exciting, really. And I remember one beautiful girl, young and beautiful, and just a graduate from Vassar. And Alice Paul sent her all over the country to speak on women's suffrage, and she was very lovely to look at and beautiful and a credit to them, too. But then suddenly I became more acquainted with her personally, and I found that she had not only become radical about women's suffrage, but she thought that it was all right for anyone to have a baby if they wanted, and they could pick the right person to be the father of the baby, and she intended to do this, carry this out. And with that, she went back home to Montana, where she came from, and visited her family and announced to them what her plans were. And her mother cried night and day and holidays and Sundays, but Hazel couldn't be stopped. And in the end, she did finally get pregnant, whereupon she got fired, because Alice Paul wasn't out to create a new life family for people. She was just interested in getting votes for women. And with that, Hazel departed for London, and later there was quite a story there about her in London. But she has since become a leader there and married the man that she went, that who was the father of her child, and so on. But
at least, did Alice Paul have any other vision of society? Was she a socialist, or was she only interested in suffrage?
No, Alice Paul was a woman with a one-track mind, and she still is. And as a matter of fact, after Mrs. Catt finally got the amendment passed by the 38th state, which was Tennessee, and that's a story in itself, how that happened. After she got that passed, she came on to Washington, and we had a great meeting in Washington to celebrate her victory in Tennessee. And Alice Paul didn't take much part in that celebration, but the day after Mrs. Catt's arrival, and then the day after Tennessee had okayed the woman suffrage amendment, which is now a law, Alice Paul put into the Congress the Equal Rights Amendment, and that was 19 years ago. And this is added proof that Alice Paul was a woman with just one mind, a one-track mind. And although she got woman suffrage, she still did not think that woman suffrage was going to give women what they thought suffrage would give them, everything they wanted. And she was right. They only got the vote, and the Supreme Court now says that the only status that women have today is as voters. And any state today still can pass any law they like against women, and the women have no recourse except perhaps to vote against the men that pass those laws. Well, that's very complicated. So there are now 1,000 very bad laws on the records of state legislatures against women. So Alice Paul was right. Getting woman suffrage wasn't enough. It was just the first step, and she's still alive, still fighting for the whole step, so that women will be equal citizens with men in the United States. They've had a terrible fight with her about it, but it's good enough. But she was such a perfectionist. There was just one way she wanted that worded. And this woman that's out here in... now I have just had a letter from her, and she's been back there working with Alice Paul on getting it through the Legislative Equal Rights Amendment. And but she's still alive now, by Jove.
What was the
she's
relationship?
She's pretty close to 90, I think.
I think she's about 88.
Yeah, yeah. She's I don't like the type of woman she is personally. Of course, I like balanced women that are married and have children and family. She's a fanatic.
What was the relationship like between Alice Paul and Mrs. Catt?
Oh, it was a very fierce relationship, because Alice Paul originally was connected with Mrs. Katz's organization. And then this disagreement came on how they were to carry on the fight, and Alice Paul would not give in an inch that any man that voted against the suffrage, she included the party as well. And so in the end, it was a very antagonistic situation between Mrs. Katz and Alice Paul, and Mrs. Katz's entire following. They would have nothing to do with each other at all. But it wasn't really a personal antagonism. It was an antagonism brought about by the philosophy of carrying on the work. It was a different way of working, that's all. And they represented this different way. But in the end, of course, it's been Alice Paul that's kept that Equal Rights Amendment alive, because as soon as the women got the vote, they just quit. It's one of the tragedies of the whole era that a slump took place. They stopped getting high degrees in colleges. They stopped trying to be better educated. They just slumped, and the whole woman's movement, the fire and the excitement that had been roused by Mrs. Katz and this whole thing, died down, and there was no fight left.
Do you think that part of that may have been because the woman's block disappeared after that?
Yes.
And they became the League of Women Voters, and rather than being interested in women, they became interested just in
government.
Do you think that was part of it?
Well, Mrs. Katz was disappointed very much in the League of Women Voters for that reason, that she felt it lost its meaning by just limiting itself to government issues. But not many people agree with that, because they've done a great work in this country of getting women better trained on government and how it works, and they've been very successful in, though conservative, but in the city councils, in the state governments, they've taught their members how government works, how to influence government, and I think they've been great.
Was Mrs. Katz's notion that it should remain as a woman's block, though?
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. I don't know just what she would have liked to have done with it, but not to have it so concentrated on government, but more on getting women. I'll never forget, I was when on our trip west, we were in Las Vegas, and she spoke in the high school there, and I remember her talk so well. She said, "We've spent 50 years giving the vote to women and the freedom to women," and she said, "It's going to be your responsibility to the high school girls of how you're going to use that freedom," and she said, "That's going to be the most difficult of all." And we, now as we look at America, we can see what's happening to women and women's programs and women's philosophy, and the decisions they're making are utterly unexpected and difficult from anything that she'd ever thought of. And how wise those decisions are, we don't know.
What, at the founding convention of the League of Women Voters, was the last meeting of the National American Women's...
1920.
Can you describe that meeting a little bit? Remember?
Well, I was asked, I was invited to come to that meeting, and I sat on the platform when the League of Women Voters was born. And it was not a controversial issue. It had all been thought out, as Mrs. Katz always did. Mrs. Katz was a statesman. I think she was, I knew many statesmen in Washington, and she had what it takes to be a great statesman. And so she had the plans all made, and Maud Wood Park was appointed the national president. She lived in Boston, of the National League of Women Voters. So that whole meeting was all very peaceful and very happy that they were through with suffrage and could now go on and get the women prepared for the new program ahead. And so it was a very peaceful and very impressive, and Mrs. Katz had that gift of dramatizing things in a very human way that was beautiful and noble. There was a nobility about her and a high spiritual thinking that she put back of what she did. And that was the feeling of that meeting, of uplifting. The big battle that they'd fought so many years was over. Now they were on the edge of the new world that was coming. And how were they going to help create that new world? And she put a beautiful spirit of imagery and spirituality and idealism into the meeting. Everybody was very deeply impressed spiritually by the way the whole thing was handled.
So at that meeting then, the National American Women's Suffrage Association was disbanded.
That's right.
And the League of Women Voters took its place.
Was created.
And
then they had a meeting right after it, and I was appointed the first legislative advocate, they called it.
Now, this was after the ratification of all the states, though.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, the vote was now passed. The fight was over. As soon as Tennessee okayed it, that was the 38th state. And the battle was over.
Do you have any recollections about that battle, of the state-by-state fight in your trip and some of the impressions you had?
Well, of course, when we took that trip through the West, that was to hurry up the states with the ratification. And I remember, of course, it was a very thrilling experience for me because I was young and never gone on a trip like that. And there was crowds at the railway stations when we got there. And then Mrs. Catt was always housed in one of the big hotels, and all of us were there with her. But everything was so well thought out, and they had these beautiful big meetings. And I sat back of Mrs. Catt as she spoke. And, of course, I'd been studying public speaking for years. And in fact, she gave me my first lessons on those platforms, how to speak. But I noticed she was wringing her hands behind her when she was speaking. And so I asked her, "Why do you wring your hands behind you?" It's because, she said, "I suffer so when I'm speaking. I'm in agony." Well, she was a shy woman. She was one of those people that basically she was shy. She didn't want to be out in front of people. So I said, "Well, then why did you choose this career that you've had?" And she said, "I didn't choose it. It chose me and wouldn't let me go." And I think the interesting thing is that her first husband that she'd married when she was quite young had died. And then this manufacturer, very rich manufacturer in New York, Mr. Catt, and I've forgotten his first name, Norman Catt, I think it was, wanted to marry her. And she said to him, "But you see, I'm already wedded to my cause." And he said, "It would be a great honor, how little I would see you, just to have you in my home occasionally. I wouldn't ask for much. But this I would like, to enjoy the presence of such a lovely person." And I think that's a beautiful story. And he did give her lots of money and left a lot of money for her to start the League of Women Voters. And to think that all those years that she spoke, she was in that kind of agony that because she was definitely a shy person, and yet her cause was so great that it just made her go ahead with it.
How many states did you go to on that tour? Do you remember?
There was Colorado and Nevada and California, and I don't remember. Oh, when we got to California, they had us speak in the Senate room and I spoke from the platform of the California Senate. We all did. And, of course, I talked about the meatpackers investigation. And at every state where we were, there was a row of meatpacker lawyers listening. And if I had made one tongue slip that was not on the record in Washington, they would have sued her for misrepresentation. So Mrs. Catt wasn't too easy because she didn't want them to kill woman suffrage if the women were going to stick their noses into things like this meatpacking industry. But I remember at every meeting seeing those men sitting up there in the balcony. And of course I just spoke from the point of view of the public record that I'd got at the hearings in Washington.
Now, what did the other people on the platform usually talk about?
Oh, it was the regular woman suffrage talk that they'd been doing for years.
Mm-hmm. Everyone else spoke about suffrage.
Yes.
You were the only one who spoke about it.
I think, in a way, I was kind of refreshing because it was a different talk and it looked to the future. And this was an issue, the kind of an issue that the women in the future should technically be interested in as consumers. So it put a new, and my future husband, who was not my husband then, gave me the title. I read him my speech, and he said, well, the speech is all right, but the title's no good. And the title he gave me was The Government in the Market Basket. And so that made excellent publicity, too. When I got back from that trip, that was 1920, and that December I was married.
Now, on that trip, when you would go into a city, and the local suffrage people would arrange the meetings.
Oh, yes. And tremendous publicity. Oh, she got tremendous publicity. And an interesting thing, too, was the smooth way that she ran her organization. People couldn't do enough for her, and they were eager to help, and there was this great enthusiasm, and her speeches were really great orations. She was, her speeches were oratorical, and they were really great speeches. They weren't just superficial. They were tied in with the history of government and the theory of democracy and what it all meant. It wasn't just a superficial speech about the adoration of women, but the whole philosophy of the right of the individual to govern themselves was involved. And I used to think I had never heard better speeches. They were really oratorical.
The whole idea was to appeal to the men, to put pressure on their local governments to ratify?
Well, of course, there were an awful lot of men there. It was the women that had to put the pressure on the men.
So
she told them what to do.
Women.
Oh yes, it was in the daytime, of course, all the big meetings and big luncheons and all.
I see.
And so she, of course, had to fire up the women to go after their state legislature and endorse this. And there was no trouble, of course, in the western states.
Now, was California the only state, though, in which you were actually able to appear in the legislature itself, or were you able to do that?
That was the only one. The women, the state legislature was in recess, and so they got permission to have us meet in the Senate of the state of California, and we sat on the platform and made our speeches from there.
Now, your trip was mainly in the western states then?
I think six states we went to in the west, that was all.
So you weren't actually involved in Tennessee then?
No, I wasn't involved there, but I got the first very close report of it.
And what
I didn't go to Tennessee.
And how did that was the final state to ratify, wasn't it?
Now that's quite a story. You want me to go into that?
Okay, why don't we go into that story about Tennessee?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's one of the most interesting stories, and of course, Mrs. Katz's heart sank that it was Tennessee that was to make this final decision, because they didn't look on Tennessee as a very radical or advanced state. And they were right when she got down there in the summer, in the heat of the summer, in a non-air-conditioned hotel. The humid temperature was terrible. And the state legislature was called just for this purpose, and all the anti-suffragists were there. And why the railroads and the Western Union were the principal business interests to fight it, I never understood, but they were there against it. And then when the state legislative men came into town, they were met at the train and invited to a certain room in the hotel where they were all given Tennessee whiskey. What do you call it when it's made in the state? Boone. Homemade whiskey.
Uh-huh.
This was the era of prohibition. And so the result was that for a solid week after they came out of that hotel drunk, they couldn't have any meeting of the legislature, which was the reason why they what do they call that, moonshine. Oh, yes, they were given this moonshine whiskey. And, of course, it was prohibition time, and whiskey was hard to find and everything. So there the suffragists sat in that hotel in agony, and no legislative, they hadn't met. Then the leader of the state legislature had said he was going to endorse it, and he changed his mind during that week. So they were one vote short of getting what they wanted when the legislature finally met. And finally, the first motion that was put to the legislature was that now they were going to vote on the woman suffrage amendment. And so the vote was put and carried by one. The one vote that they needed was carried. So then they put the vote, should the Tennessee legislature endorse the woman suffrage amendment, and they started to call the roll when they hit a young man named Barnes right near the alphabet, and to the horror of everybody, he changed his vote. See, all of them were voting no, see, and then they got to his vote and he said aye, and everything paused, and the men rushed up and started beating him on the back and asked him to change his vote. He'd made a mistake, and he said no. He was in favor of it. And they went on and called the roll, and it was won by one vote. And so everybody went up to him, and he pulled a letter out of his pocket from his mother up in the mountains of Tennessee. And she said, "Dear son, I've been watching the fight for woman suffrage." Oh, before this vote took place, I forgot. One of the newspaper women got somehow into Mrs. Katz's room and put a bottle of whiskey under her pillow. And, of course, the question was, what was she to do with the whiskey? Because if she poured it down the drain, the whole hotel would smell of it. Then the news would go out that the women were now taking on whiskey, see? So they had a terrible time just deciding how to get rid of this whiskey. And but one of her staunch women, one of the older women, and she finally wrapped the whiskey up in a bundle, got a carriage, and drove way out in the country and buried the whiskey under a stone wall and came back minus the whiskey. So they got around that order. Well, anyway, then this young man pulled a letter out of his pocket and it said, "Dear son, I've been watching the fight of Mrs. Cat. I think it's a shame. Now be a good boy and help Mrs. Cat put the rat in ratification. Your mother." Well, the whole place just hit the ceiling. Whoever heard of such a letter, you know? And so the newspaper men got in the car and beat it up to the mountains. And the purpose was to get her to change her mind and meet again and get the boy to change his mind. And when they got up there, she was just coming in with her pail of milk late in the day. And she invited them to sit down at the kitchen table. And they said, we don't understand this letter. How'd you happen to write a letter like this?" And she said, "Well, you see, in the winter, you know, my son and I are up here. It's very lonely." So she said, "We spend the winter nights reading Shakespeare. And I just thought, well, why shouldn't I play around with words like Shakespeare did? So that's why I put that in about the rat and ratification." And that woman gave 17 million women the vote, which proves that democracy works when everybody votes. Sooner or later, you're going to get the right vote. Somebody's going to save the day.
Now, Jesse, is it true that afterwards they discovered that they didn't need the Tennessee vote?
Well, then Connecticut immediately endorsed it.
Oh, I see.
And they hadn't done it. So they would have gotten it in the end.
Oh, I see.
Connecticut immediately endorsed it, too, to solidify the whole thing, because they kept trying to hold another meeting and to react and get a reaction. So Connecticut came to the rescue and quickly endorsed it.
Because I've come across there have been two different dates for the final ratification. One was, I think, August 18th, and the other is August 26th, which is, of course, the day that's considered the commemoration.
Well, it may have been there was another one besides Connecticut. I know afterwards the Tennessee thing didn't seem so vital as it did at the moment when that vote was taken, see. at the, they of course, had two other states that came to their rescue. Mm-hmm. But at the Tennessee did it, just to say. Mm-hmm. Tennessee gave it to them.
Do you recall where the colors of that banner, the suffrage banner that Alice Paul and her group used, what was it, do you recall any of the, what the symbol of that was, or what the symbol that
those... She probably had a symbol.